start with an introduction to Tanya. So this is a book that was written by the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Alter Rebbe, whose name was Rabbi Schneur Zalman of Liadi. And he is the founder of the Chabad Hasidus movement. What that means is that the Baal Shem Tov, the great rabbi whose name was Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov, began to spread the teachings of the mystical elements of the Torah. For that, we have to back up yet a little bit more for a moment, and we have to explain that when Hashem gave us the Torah, Hashem gave the Torah to the prophets, and the prophets were the ones who were given the information to teach to all the other people. We believe in Judaism, of course, in Yiddishkeit, in the concept of nevuah, prophecy, that Hashem speaks to people, the idea of revelation, that God tells us what he wants and what he thinks and what he feels. Where did the revelation begin? It began with the very first human beings, Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve. And that God, Hashem, spoke to them, and Hashem told them, and Hashem gave them information. And that information was on two levels, at least two levels. On one level, it's the information of, what do I want from you? So that's very important. If you have a child, and you have even a machine that you're building, first thing you do is you program the machine, or you set up the machine to work a certain way. If it's not a computer-based machine, but if you are the individual who makes that machine, then you set up the machine. And of course, in the case of Hashem, Hashem sets up all of us human beings, and Hashem has a program for us. Hashem has things that he wants us to do. And that began with Adam. That began with the first human beings. The first human beings, I am muted. Unmute myself. No, not muted. I don't think I'm muted. Doesn't look like I'm muted. Why does it say I'm muted? I don't know why I'm muted. At any rate, it starts with Adam. And Adam was given instructions. And according to tradition, he was given six mitzvahs that he has to fulfill. And besides all the mitzvahs, besides what to do, Adam was taught, the first man was taught, the mystical secrets of creation. What that means is, how did Hashem as a chemist, how did Hashem as a physicist, how did Hashem as a creator, inventor, create the world? What were the energies, the spiritual energies that Hashem used to create the angels, to create the physical world, the animals, himself, the world itself? How does the world move from the spiritual, from the unlimited energy of Hashem? How does that energy morph? How does it turn into something that's physical? And how is it maintained, and how does it work? Exactly the way a physicist or a chemist would study chemistry, and a biologist would study biology, and so on. How does a scientist, how does the world work? So Hashem explained to Adam how the world works. And that information was passed down. We find this in the Chumash, that the Torah it alludes to this right at the beginning of the Chumash, that Adam had this information. And then we find that Adam taught this information to his children. Now, not all of the children were so, as we say in Yiddish, ay, ay, ay. They weren't exactly all such good kids. That's just the story of the human beings. Some of the children were very rebellious. Some of the children weren't interested in learning. Some of the children were interested in worshiping idols. Some of the children were interested in murdering and pillaging and raping and robbing and killing. And they weren't interested. That's just what happens, unfortunately. So just like we have to worry about our kids, he had to worry about his kids. And the next generation had to worry about their kids. That's just the human condition. And the Torah says that, in fact, three generations later, people already were all messed up. But they were always good. They were always good people. Until we read in the Chumash about Noah. And then, of course, we read about Abraham, 20 generations. So 20 generations after Adam, Torah tells us, came our patriarch, Abraham. And he was the one who turned things around in a very positive way. That means that they were always good people. They were always great tzaddikim, meaning in each generation. And in fact, they were Abraham's grandparents, because just as the way it is, Abraham is 20 generations descended from Adam. And they taught Abraham the mystical information that was originally given to Adam. So who was it specifically? So the tradition is that this was Noah who taught it to Shem, and Shem, who was Noah's son, taught it to his grandson Aver. So Shem and Aver, according to mystical tradition, according to tradition, established actually an academy. Rambam actually tells us this, established, according to Midrash, established an academy in the land of Israel where they would teach all of this mystical tradition, all of this information that Adam had received from Hashem. And Abraham went to study in that academy for many years. He studied in that academy. And what was special about Abraham, the Torah tells us, is that he didn't just keep it for himself. He wasn't just satisfied that he himself should know this. He went and he taught it on a very wide scale level. He wrote many books, Rambam tells us. He wrote hundreds of books. He was a publisher. He was an author. He was a speaker. He was a podcast guy. He popularized. He had hundreds and hundreds of people, maybe thousands of people, who were following his understanding and who followed Abraham. And that's why Hashem loved Abraham. Hashem loved Abraham because he was counterculture. He was an iconoclast. An iconoclast is just a word that means an idol smasher. He didn't believe in the idols. He didn't believe in the current think. He went back to the sources. He didn't invent. He went back to the sources of what the information had been given to Adam and to Abraham and to Noah and to Shem and to Aver. And he went against the powers of the day, as the expression says, speak truth to power. That's what he did. He put his life on the line with Mesiras Nefesh, with self-sacrifice. And that's what Torah Chumash tells us. That's why Hashem loved Abraham. And Abraham wrote a book. And the book, according to our tradition, we have still till today, it's called the Book of Formation, Sefer Yetzirah. And in fact, Adam wrote a book, and we have that book until today. It's called the Sefer of Raziel HaMalach, the angel Raziel. And whether it's all of it or part of it, that he wrote, exactly what the text is, we're not 100% sure how much of it is exactly, but that's what it is. We even have quotes from Adam in the book of Tehillim. There are fragments and quotations from Adam. So our tradition is very, very rich, very clear, very precise. And when I say our, I mean the Jewish tradition is very precise in the order of what's called in Hebrew the Mesorah, the tradition, the information that was handed down from generation to generation. Eventually, that information, meaning all of the mystical information, the information of how the world is created, the information of how we are neshama, how our soul gives life to our body, how does it work? How does the spiritual world enliven and create and continue to perpetuate the physical world? And how does the spiritual world itself work? How do the angels work? How do the levels work? How do the stages of energy coming down? How does all that work? Eventually, that was hidden. That was lost. What it means it was lost is it wasn't lost from everybody. It was lost from the masses. The great, great leaders, the great Torah teachers of each generation, had that information, and they taught it amongst themselves. And if you were not worthy, if you were not 100% knowledgeable in all the areas of Torah, you were not initiated, you were not allowed to enter, you didn't understand. This is stuff that people didn't learn. So what did the simple Jews learn? They learned how to keep Shabbos. They learned how to keep kosher. They learned how to not to steal. What are the laws of being honest? What are the laws of contract law and all kinds of different stuff that you need to run your life on a overt level, on an ordinary day-to-day level. But all of this mystical stuff, it's like the same thing saying, oh, who's a physicist? Who's talking about the theoretical mathematics? Why do you have to talk about theoretical mathematics? Who cares about theoretical? Who does that? Some people sitting in an ivory tower. So that's what the mystical knowledge of the Torah was kept by the great sages. Now, there were thousands and thousands of great sages at different times. And sometimes there were hundreds, sometimes there were tens, depending on how the persecution of the Jews was going and we were being kicked out of Israel, kicked out of here, punished this, running here, who knows what. Sometimes it was only a handful that kept up the tradition. But there was always, the tradition was always kept up. And in fact, again, Rambam tells us who were the great leaders of each generation. There were only 40 leaders, Rambam says, from the time of Moshe until the time that everything was written down in times of the Talmud, only 40 great leaders. So it's not like, you know, thousands of generations, 40 generations, one taught the other. And the great leaders, when it came time finally to the Second Temple was destroyed by Rome. This is around the Common Era, 68, according to our tradition. And for a good hundred years before that, Rome was very, very strong in persecuting the Jews in Israel. And if it wasn't Rome, it was the Syrian Greeks and the story of Hanukkah. 200 years before, 100 years before that, and then the Hellenists let Rome in, and the whole story with this Jewish history. And there was a lot of persecution. The Jewish kings themselves weren't exactly that great to the Jews. A lot of persecution, a lot of problems. Eventually, the temple, Second Temple, was destroyed, as I mentioned, the year 68. And the Jews were kicked out of Israel, mostly. Some stayed for a little bit, for a while. We're always Jews, always. But as far as the greater community of scholars, that didn't last forever. And at that time, around the Common Era, 100 years before, 100 years after, till a few hundred years after, the sages felt that they have to record everything. Everything has to be written down. Until that point, you were actually not allowed to record things. It was supposed to be orally transmitted for people who were worthy of sitting and spending time and giving it proper attention and vetted by the teachers. Now you can pick up a book and all of a sudden you're an expert. So everybody thinks they're an expert just because you read a book. Are you an expert? Are you worthy of the knowledge? Do you really have the understanding to not corrupt the information and transmit that information properly? Who knows? You know. But in those times, if you were vetted personally by a teacher, then they took a look. What's your personality? What's your character? Are you a fine person, honest person? Are you keeping the other laws? Or do you have the right intentions? Do you have the capacity to understand correctly and not to understand it in a twisted way? That's just the way information is. So you were not allowed to write it down. You had to be vetted by a teacher in order to be initiated into this information. And eventually, however, they did write it down for the reason that if they didn't write it down, it would have been forgotten. Too much persecution and too few transmitters of the information left, too few scholars left. And eventually it was written down in a book called the Zohar. And it was also written down, this mystical information, it was also written down in code form in other books called the Midrash and in parts of the Talmud, parts of the Gemara, in code form. What that means, stories, parables, some fantastical seeming stories. I went to the ocean and I saw this whale that was as big as two houses together and 16 buildings and 60 sailors came and a whole fantastical story. It's not a story, it's a parable. You have to understand what it's talking about. So the information was written down for those people that understood it, that there would be sort of notes that you'd be able to go back to and say, oh, this means that. And if you didn't understand it, you looked at it and you say, somebody's telling a crazy story here. It's a tall tale, it doesn't make any sense. And that's the way it was intended to be. If you didn't understand it, you didn't understand. If you understood, you understood everything. So in fact, the great sages went back to the Chumash itself. And they showed how in the Chumash itself, you have all this information is coded into the Chumash. How is it coded into the Chumash? It's coded with the gematrias. It's coded with the numerical values of certain words. It's coded with certain key phrases being hyperlinked to other key phrases and so on. So if you understood, you understood exactly where it was written and how it was thing. And if you didn't understand, all you knew, looking at a closed book, you're walking into the museum and you see beautiful paintings on the wall. You say, oh, nice, nice painting. If you understand, you understand the work that goes into it. You understand what's happening. So that's what happened. So eventually, as I mentioned, it was written down. Now, the great sages of each generation, even before it was written down, or even without the writing, had it transmitted still orally. So it doesn't mean there weren't great sages who had the oral information. They still did. This book, the Zohar, was discovered, it was hidden. Hidden. It was written down by a great sage whose name is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, 2nd century, 3rd century sage, and he lived in Israel. He was 2nd century, lived right after the Common Era, so we're talking about, I guess you could call him a 1st century sage. And he persecuted by the Romans, hid in the cave, famous story of Rabbi Shimon Yochai, the festival Lag BaOmer is partially about, half at least, about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. So you may have heard the name Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And he wrote this Zohar together with his disciples. He was the main person to write it, the leader of the teacher of the group. And that book, however, was hidden. It was not to be discovered until approximately 1,200 years later in the 1300s. And the information, however, was still known by the great sages of each generation, although the text itself was hidden. And eventually the text was discovered, and it was discovered in the 1300s. And then at that time, it began to be taught. And our understanding is that the reason it was hidden is because the generation didn't need it, the wider generation. And the reason it was discovered is because at that point, the generation needed that information. A few hundred years after that came the Baal Shem Tov, Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov. Early 1700s, Baal Shem Tov was very active. And the Baal Shem Tov, and together with his group of tzaddikim, understood that the Jewish nation needs to have some pick-me-up. This was after the Chmelnytsky massacres. This was after the Tach V'Tat. It's called the Gzeres Tach V'Tat. In Jewish years, it's 5,408 and 409, about 300 years ago. 300 and, well, more than that, it's not 780. Three, so this is 408 and 409. So whatever, close to 400 years ago now. The Kazakh Khmelnytsky massacres, which we in the United States not familiar with, but unfortunately Eastern Europe very familiar with. And the Jews were devastated. It was a Holocaust. It was literally a Holocaust. The Jews were devastated. And they were frum, so to speak. They kept Torah mitzvahs. There was no like reform, conservative, assimilated. You couldn't assimilate even if you wanted to. Few and far between would a Jew be accepted amongst the Christians anyway, even though they wanted the Jews to convert, but you weren't really accepted as a Jew anyway. So the Jewish nation was completely shell-shocked from these, from this and from a general distancing between the simpler Jews and the more scholarly Jews. And of course, at that time, people were very poor in general, with some exceptions. And if you didn't have any money, so you had to go work at a very young age. I mean, this is the difficult times. And if you had to work at a very young age means sometimes 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, and to support the family. And of course, you weren't studying. And of course, the father had no money to send you to study by a private tutor because there were no real yeshivas, schools. So there was a lot of practice, but very little knowledge amongst a large part of the Jewish nation. And the Baal Shem Tov and his group of tzaddikim understood that the Jewish nation needs a pick-me-up. It needs a real IV injection of spirituality to get excited about being Jewish. And to get just back to yourself. And that's when they started to teach the mystical elements of the Torah, which they knew all the time. As I mentioned, they were scholars to the masses. Now, they didn't teach it, obviously, in the way that we are, that the scholars understood it, but in simpler, in parables and forms, this and that. Began to be a big opposition, naturally, amongst the scholarly, amongst the elite. First of all, why are you even hanging out with such simple people? How could you even do that? These simple people, they're not worthy of your time. It was a big snobbishness, big elitism in the Jewish nation, which still exists today, unfortunately, but not as nearly as bad as then. The Baal Shem Tov said, what do you mean? These are Jews. And he spoke about the value of the neshama, the value of the soul. And when you look from a soul perspective, from a neshama perspective, then how much you know and how little you know, or even how much you do, doesn't make a difference when it comes to your neshama. Because from a soul perspective, from a neshama perspective, it could be, the Zohar says, that a person who appears to be a very, very low spiritual level, in fact, has a greater spiritual energy power plant inside of themselves, the soul, than even a person who is a great scholar, because this is the way it is. Hashem is the one who decides which neshama you're going to have. So who are you to say, those tzaddikim said, who are you to say that this person should not be associated with? Are you crazy? How could you say that? Now, naturally, of course, the other side didn't take it very smoothly. And there was big fights to the point of actual blood, unfortunately. And it was to the point of ratting out and tattletaling on getting the secular governments involved, having the leaders of the Hasidic movement arrested. Really, the Alter Rebbe himself was twice arrested and put in jail under very, very serious circumstances because of the opposition of fellow Frum Jews. So it's really hard to understand all this. How could this be? But that's just what happened. And it's for history. The Alter Rebbe eventually began to realize that he has to write all this down. And the teaching, and the Baal Shem Tov, so not to get ahead of myself here, Baal Shem Tov had a number of students, who and his main disciple was a great, great Rebbe, great, great tzaddik, by the name of Rabbi Dov Ber of Mizrich. We call him the Magid of Mizrich, is how he's referred to, the preacher of Mizrich. So the Baal Shem Tov, Rabbi Shaul Baal Shem Tov, who lived in Mezhebush, had a student, a number of students, and his main student, disciple, who carried on his teachings was Rabbi Dober of Mizrich, the Magid of Mizrich. He had a number of students, and each of those students later went to certain villages and towns and was given the job of spreading the teachings of Chassidus, spreading the inner message of the Torah, for at least two good reasons. Why? What's so important to spread the inner message? Why? The answer is at least two good reasons. Reason number one is it gives excitement and it gives life and it gives appreciation for what you're doing. So if I told somebody you're eating certain type of food, don't eat this food anymore. Or if you're eating this and this and this, stop eating this or focus on that. And the person says, why? And then you explain to them how the body works. You explain to them how the circulatory and the system and the this and the that, the muscles and the this and the proteins and you the food. And they say, well, now I understand. So of course, and then it makes it so much easier to keep to a healthy diet if I understand what an unhealthy diet does to me and what a healthy diet, on the contrary, does good for me. So that's what Hasidus does. If you understand what mitzvahs do, you understand why mitzvahs are important, you understand what Torah is all about, you understand what Hashem is all about on a very simple level. Without studying the teachings of Hasidus, the inner teachings of the Torah, it's impossible to properly fulfill even the simple mitzvah of love Hashem, believe in Hashem. What's Hashem? What's God? Is God some, in the language of previous Rebbe, quoting one of the early people who were not on the, is God some angry buffalo in the sky who every time you do something wrong, throws some rocks down on your head? What is Hashem? Is God some benevolent old man in the sky who gives you candy every time you do something good? What is Hashem? So without understanding all of this, it's hard to understand why to do mitzvahs. And it's definitely impossible to properly fulfill the mitzvah of belief and love of Hashem and awe of Hashem and so on. And of course, besides the fulfilling mitzvahs and besides this, it also gives us the ability to bring Mashiach closer. Because the Zohar says, one of the famous teachings of the Zohar is that Mashiach is going to come when these mystical information is going to be spread to the widest possible audiences. So for these two reasons, number one, personal, selfish reason, get excited about your Yiddishkeit, about your Judaism. Get excited about doing a mitzvah. Understand why you're doing all these things. Why does the Torah say it's important to be so careful about this detail of a mitzvah? Who cares? And you think Hashem really cares if I do this, that? If I'm a good person, if I'm happy, if I'm this, doesn't God want me to be happy? So what's the point of doing all this? I'm not happy. It doesn't make me happy. Why should I do it? So well, we understand the inner meanings of the mitzvahs. You begin to understand why, and then you actually get happy. Then it actually makes your whole life totally different. So that's number one, purely selfish reasons. Number two, bring Mashiach. You're bringing Mashiach closer, and you are uniting with the entire world of not just the Jewish people, not just the non-Jewish people, but the animal world, the vegetable world, the mineral world, the entire literally creation. We understand our place in the world. Then we understand our purpose in the world. So these mystical teachings were given, were taught by Hashem to Adam for a reason, not just because. If you don't understand what the whole goal is, so the little kid, you don't have to tell the goal. You say whatever you have in your head. Why should you put on a coat? Because I said so, because I'm your mother. That's why you should put on a coat. Why should I go to sleep early? Because I said so. But as you get earlier, as you get older, you know, because I said so, it doesn't cut it anymore. You have to explain. And that is the story of the Jewish people. As we get older, meaning as we come closer to Mashiach's times, as we become more mature as a people, and our history so far is 3,335 years. That's from the time of the giving of the Torah. If you add from Adam, from Abraham, it's another 400 years before that. If you add from Adam, of course, we're 5,783 years. Then now from creation, from Adam. So as humans, we are mature. What does that mean? It means that we're growing up. What does it mean to grow up? It means to be able to understand. We don't no longer have to do things just because of I said so. Hashem wants us, in fact, to understand. And that information was given to us by Hashem in our right, in our prophecies to the great prophets, and of course, eventually written down. So that's a little bit of a background. Of course, there's much, much more than I just shared with you, but that's a little bit of a background to understand. I'm sure if somebody has a question, you can always ask, and I will amplify whatever it is that you know, you want more information about. There's lots of stuff today online. You go to Chabad.org, you just Google Wikipedia, all the Wikipedia. Sometimes you don't know what's right and what's wrong, but there's a lot of information out there. There's no question about it, but you want to have the right sources. That's very important. You read the wrong sources, and then you're completely mixed up. What is Kabbalah? What is this? Is Kabbalah Madana? Is Kabbalah self-serving? So as I just laid out for you, it's exactly the opposite. Anytime you see a Kabbalah teaching or a Kabbalah teacher or a teacher of any kind of mystical knowledge, and you ask that teacher, or the teacher tells you that the point of this information that I'm giving you is to make you happier, to make you a better person, to make you more at peace with yourself, immediately red alert. That's exactly the opposite. It's exactly the opposite. Yes, it's true that as a consequence of being spiritually aware, you will no longer have a fight, a tug of war inside yourself. But that's not what the purpose is. The purpose is to come closer to Hashem. The purpose is to be united with each other, to understand that each of us are neshamas, our souls, and to appreciate the value of a fellow Jew, and to appreciate the value of our connection with Hashem, And yes, of course, as a consequence of that, you'll be just a happier person. But if your person says it's about you, then it's red alert, because that's the tail wagging the dog and not the dog wagging the tail. I don't want to mix dogs in here, but that's what it is. So just be understanding that the purpose of Chassidus is to, the purpose of mysticism is to help us human beings become spiritual beings, to help us selfish, self-centered, egocentric, ego-driven, personal-driven, driven for our own, even for good reasons. We're driven by our personal needs, to help us become greater than the limitations of what the physical imposes on. The natural world, the physical world. We can't fly, we are physical. But if you study Chassidus, if you study Torah, yes, you can fly. It doesn't mean you can fly in the air. But yes, you soar in the air, you become connected. You realize that you're not the sum total of your physicality, of your materialism. You realize that, in fact, we are spiritual beings. We're greater, in fact, than the angels. The angels envy us. They're jealous of us that we can fulfill mitzvahs. I heard a beautiful story the other day that there was one of the great teachers of Torah, one of the great Torah scholars, lived hundreds of years ago, was the Maharam of Rutenberg, Maharam of Rutenberg. And unfortunately, he was arrested by the local king, whatever it was of his location. He lived on the borders of France and Switzerland, one of those towns. I forget the name of the town. And he was arrested, and they wanted a lot of ransom. And this guy wanted the Jewish community to pay up. That it was just a mechanism of Mexico. They kidnap people for ransom. Exact same story. It's always been happening. And he told their people were ready to pay, but the Maram himself told a very holy, very great tzaddik. He told the community, "No, I don't want you to do that, because if you do that, then he's going to arrest the next person, next person, next person. And I'll stay here in prison." And he was okay and this and that. And he lived out his life and he died in prison. Well, this guy was very, very mean, very cruel, obviously. And he did not allow, even after the Maharam passed away, he did not allow his body to be taken by the Jewish community and buried. Eventually, there was a very wealthy man in the community, years later, after his passing, who gave almost all of his fortune, and he paid a lot of money, and the Maram was allowed to be released, his body was allowed to be and buried. Story is that the Maram came to him in a dream, and he said, "Thank you for doing this for me, and I'm giving you a choice as a reward. Would you like to have all your money back? You're going to become super wealthy, even wealthier than before. Your business will succeed in all kinds of different ways. Or would you like to be buried next to me and be with me in paradise, in Gan Eden?" Think about it, and whatever your decision is, that's what you're going to get. Well, this person decided that he wants to be buried next to the Maram, so he instructed his family, put his affairs in order. The next day he died, and in fact, that's where he was buried, the cemetery next to him. And I guess he's together in Gan Eden, you know. One of the great Hasidim, Chabad Hasidim, when telling the story, would say that this person made the wrong choice. So made the wrong choice. How could he have made the wrong choice? Physical life is temporary. Spiritual life is permanent. He's in Gan Eden with the Maram of Rutenberg. Made the wrong choice, because if he would have stayed alive, he could have put on tefillin for that many more days. He could have done mitzvahs here in the physical world for that many more days. Hashem would put him wherever Hashem wants to put him. Well, you have to give an address. If you do mitzvahs, you go in the right place. God puts you where you're supposed to belong. But to do a mitzvah, nobody can understand the value of doing a mitzvah. One mitzvah, all the angels are jealous of a Jew doing one mitzvah. So how could he give that up just to have his reward, so to speak, eat the dessert right now? So that's, anyway, that's the story. So how do we understand this without studying Chassidus? You can't understand this, the value of doing the mitzvah. So that is the little overview for the book of Tanya. So Alter Rebbe wrote Tanya in the late 1700s. It actually published 96, 97, 98 eventually. And the 1796 first time, so 97. The Alter Rebbe wrote the Tanya, and in the introduction to Tanya, the Alter Rebbe says, the reason I'm writing this book is because people are coming to me and asking how to serve Hashem the proper way, how to appreciate doing mitzvahs, how to be able to approach the study of Torah the proper way, how to be a real Jew, how to have the right attitude. It's not a book that teaches us the ins and outs of how to do each mitzvah. That's the Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law. There are other books that teach us how to do specifically the mitzvah and how to daven and how to have a mezuzah and how to keep kosher and how to keep Shabbos. That's not what the Tanya is about. The Tanya is a book, how to have the proper attitude, how to have the proper understanding of what it is that we're doing and why it is that we're doing exactly these things. The Alter Rebbe further said that every question that you could only have is going to be answered in this book. If you can understand it, fine, good for you. If you can't understand how the question is, find somebody who can understand. Every question of any kind in attitude, in personality, in how to live life and how to approach life, every question is answered in this book. So that's what it is. So the Tanya, therefore, is a very, very powerful book, very, very holy book. And we, as Lubavitcher Chassidim, refer to the Tanya as the Torah Shebichsav of Chassidus. That means the written Torah of the Hasidic information. Just as the Chumash is precise in every single letter, the Alter Rebbe agonized according to tradition over every single letter, over the punctuation, over whether to add an extra vav, an extra and, this, or connect two concepts or separate two concepts. The Tanya is very, very precise. So, a very holy book and extremely powerful, not only when you understand it, but even just reading the concepts already elevates the person. Of course, the goal is, as with all Torah, to understand, to bring it into your intellectual, to elevate your intellect, and therefore, and then to elevate your emotional attachment. So that is a little bit of an overview. And let me share with you the first concepts that the Alter Rebbe speaks about in Tanya, chapters 1 and 2. The Alter Rebbe asks a question. This is chapters 1 and 2. Let me give you a little bit of an overview. The Alter Rebbe asks a question. And Tanya starts with a question. And by the way, the word Tanya itself is an Aramaic word that simply means we have learned. Happens to be a name today, but it means in Aramaic, ancient language, we have studied, we have learned. The Zohar writes that the word Tanya, if you change around the letters, rearrange the letters, also has the same letters and the same word as Eitan, Eitan, which is actually a popular Hebrew name today, Eitan. In Ashkenazic pronunciation, we say Eitan. But Eitan is a popular name. And what does it mean? It means strength. The word Eitan means strength. The word Tanya means to study. The word Eitan means strength. And the Alter Rebbe and Chassidim explain that by studying Tanya, you bring out the strength, the power, the attachment to Hashem, that's already inside each and every one of us. You bring out the power of the connection to Hashem that each Jew has just by virtue of having a neshama, just because Hashem gave us a soul. So we're clearly connected. You know, if you see a car that's driving down the road, you say it probably has a motor. The way it could be electric nowadays, but it has a motor. So that's the way it is. So you see a person that's alive and talking and just living and breathing, probably has spiritual energy, because of that, where are you coming from? Where is your life from? So that's, but to bring that out and to recognize that and to have your spiritual energy be front and center and be part of your appreciation for everything that you're doing, that's a big deal. And that's what the Tanya brings out the Eisan Sheben Neshama, the power of the Neshama, power of the soul. So anyway, the Alter Rebbe starts Tanya with a question. And the question Alter Rebbe asks is, it says in the Gemara that when a person is born, when every individual is born, there is an angel that gives you your personality. Up in heaven, there's a big factory creating people and humans. And before you're born, there is a process, the Gemara says, where there is a special angel that is supposed to give you your person. Everybody has different personalities, and happier, not so happy, smarter, dumber, all kinds of different things. So this angel tells you, listen, I'm going to make you like this, like this, like this, but I am warning you, little neshama, you're going to be born into a big world. Do not be a Rasha. Don't be wicked. Don't be wicked. That's what the angel says. And the angel further says that even if everybody tells you you're a tzaddik, you're completely righteous, regard yourself as wicked, as a Rasha. The Alter Rebbe says, regard yourself as a Rasha. Why should you regard yourself as a Rasha? And what is this angel telling you? Don't be wicked, but yet consider yourself as if you're a Rasha. Alter Rebbe asked another few questions. I'm not going to get into every one of the questions. And eventually the Alter Rebbe explains that when we say the word tzaddik and we say the word Rasha, which means righteous and wicked, it means something different in the mystical sense, in the absolute sense, than it means in the colloquial sense, in the sense that people use it in the street, in ordinary language. In ordinary language, when people say, oh, that person's a tzaddik, it means the person did something right. The old joke is that a person dies and goes up to heaven and comes to heaven. This is the way that it's a joke. They say, we don't have any place for you, because you're so righteous. You're such an amazing person. You've done such amazing, wonderful things that we don't even have a place to put you. There's no part of heaven that was good enough for you. We're going to let you come back to life. We're going to give you another week or so to live. And in that time, you have to do at least one thing wrong, so that at least you should be able to live with everybody else. How can we put you on a plateau above everybody? That's the way the story goes. It's a joke. So a person all of a sudden is on the deathbed, wakes up, everybody's all excited. He realizes he has this information in his head, he realizes he has to do something. So he goes over to his neighbor, who was giving him tsaris all his life, and he punches him in the nose so hard, the guy is knocked out cold, bleeding, nosebleed on the floor. And he's so excited that now he did something wrong, and now he is going to go to heaven finally, and they'll find him his final resting place. Unfortunately, just at that moment, the man's wife, who's there, says to him, oh, you're such a tzaddik. You don't know what a mitzvah you just did. So obviously, he wasn't that good to his wife either. So this is obviously a joke. We call a person a tzaddik. So what does a tzaddik mean? A tzaddik means we say a person who is generally a righteous, generally does good. That's not the Alter Rebbe says what a tzaddik means. And what does a Rasha, a wicked person, mean? A wicked person, we say, means a person who is mostly bad. You know, you look at the guy, you look at the woman, and you say, oh, what a terrible person. That's not what a Rasha means either, in the absolute sense. That's how people use the term. But in the absolute sense, the Alter Rebbe says, you have to define the terms in order to be able to understand the concepts. You got to define your terms. And the way the terms are defined, the Alter Rebbe says, and he brings proofs from the Gemara, that in fact, this must be the meaning, and it's clear that that's what the meaning is. the absolute sense. A tzaddik is a person who doesn't have an evil inclination, does not have any impetus, any push to do anything wrong. A rasha is a person who has an evil inclination, and he listens to that evil inclination even for the smallest thing, even the smallest sin, the smallest something, even to the point of getting angry, even to the point of being arrogant, not even an outward sin, even some deficiency that the person is not 100%. So what's between tzaddik and rasha? The answer is between tzaddik and rasha, what's called a beinoni. A beinoni, which literally means an intermediate person. An intermediate person is a person who never does anything wrong, not outwardly and not inwardly, but has the capacity to do something wrong if they let their guard down. Today we would say like an alcoholic, like an addict who has recovered. A recovering addict, well, person who has not had an addiction to whatever it is, 25 years, has not touched that thing, gets up and says, I am an addict. I am an alcoholic. You haven't drank for 25 years. So what do you mean you're an alcoholic? Well, if I drink one drink, I'm down the tubes. I'm out. The Alter Rebbe says, that's how each of us is supposed to regard ourselves. That's the level we can reach. We can reach the level of being perfect in all our actions. Of course, almost nobody actually has reached that level. A few people have reached that level, but we can. Each individual has the capacity to reach that level of perfection where we are actually perfect in all our actions, inwardly and outwardly. However, we do not have the capacity to get rid of that little monkey on our back, that little voice inside of us that is our Yetzer Hara, our evil inclination. Only a few people, literally small, less than a handful, of Rebbe says in each generation, have that capacity if Hashem makes you that way to begin with. You got to have that as a gift from God that you can't accomplish with your own work. The Alter Rebbe further explains that the reason that we have a struggle in our lives is because we in fact have not one power plant, but two power plants. We have two what's called a nefesh eloki, a soul that is completely on mission, completely on point, always connected with Hashem, has absolutely no yetzer hara, has absolutely no evil inclination. But Alter Rebbe says Hashem balances that out with another power plant that is egotistic by nature, selfish, animalistic. Animalistic doesn't mean that necessarily doesn't mean that the person acts like an animal, but it acts out of self-interest, ego. So we would say we have one soul that's spiritual, divine, completely selfless, connected to our creator all the time. We have one, another soul that is animalistic, egotistic, central to our own personal desires. Every person, obviously, is born with a different type of animal soul, animalistic soul. We call it the natural soul. Every person is born with different levels of how egotistic you are and how refined you are. We have anybody with a few kids knows, oh, this kid, spiritual kid. This kid, oh, what a bunch of demons this kid is dealing with. Oh, what a handful he or she is going to be. You know, that's the way it is. We know from ourselves at certain times of the day, certain times of the in our development, in our life, depending what's happening to us, when our spiritual side is more elevated and more accessible, when our materialistic side is giving us more trouble. You know, maybe when you're younger, maybe when you're faced with certain different things in your life, who knows what? So Alter Rebbe explains that this is not one power plant that's mixed up, that's confused. And the reason that we have ups and downs in our spiritual attachment is not because we have one power plant that doesn't know which way to connect itself. Alter Rebbe says, no, because we have these two power plants, because we have these two neshamas, We therefore are sometimes motivated more by one and more by the other. And this, the Alter Rebbe says, is a gift that Hashem gives only to the Jewish nation. Anybody who is not a Jew only has one power plant. Now again, the natural soul is not evil. It's not bad. It's just egotistic. It's just self-serving. What's wrong with being self-serving? What's wrong with being interested in earning a living and in being healthy and in exercising properly and in having a wonderful place to live in? There's nothing wrong with that. As a matter of fact, if you don't do any of those things, it's considered to be you're not properly serving Hashem either, because you're not taking care of your body, you're not taking care of your environment. But if that's the ultimate reason, only because I am I and therefore I need this, then again, you're serving yourself, you're worshiping yourself. The non-Jewish world, the Alter Rebbe explains, does not have the capacity to be selfless. They have the capacity to be excelling in every aspect, to do wonderful stuff. But at the end of the day, if you really probe, if you really dig, it's because of self-perpetuation, self-serving. Again, self-serving is not necessarily a bad thing. Matter of fact, it's a wonderful thing if the things that you're doing benefit yourself plus other people. So as an example, in our Torah, it says, and we know this very famous, so to speak, golden rule, it says, Ve'ahavta l're'acha kamocha. You should love your fellow as yourself. Love your fellow as yourself. Question, how can you love your fellow as yourself, really? It's a nice thing to say, but how can you really love your fellow as yourself? It's really ridiculous. My fellow is my fellow, and I am me. Am I going to love the other person as much as I love me? I mean, who am I fooling? You can do wonderful things for your fellow, but at the end of the day, who do you really, really care about more? You have to be crazy to love somebody as much as you love yourself. Alter Rebbe asks this question in Tanya. Alter Rebbe explains that because we each have a neshama, and our neshamas are in fact coming from the same source, so our neshamas really is one neshama. So it's like saying your right hand should love your left hand as much as it loves itself. Yes, that's possible because you're part of one body. So in the Jewish nation, our neshamas are all connected. So it is in fact possible. It takes work, still not simple, still not easy, but it is at least possible. The non-Jewish world, however, which does not have that type of neshama connection, in the non-Jewish world, the non-Jewish world doesn't say, love your fellow as yourself. They say, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Or they say in the negative, don't do unto others as you would not have them do unto you. That's how they translate. If you look it up in Wikipedia, there is a very fascinating article in Wikipedia that goes through that expression in every culture, in every language. It exists in every culture, exists almost every language, probably every language. And the way it's stated is exactly that way. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. As a matter of fact, in our Gemara, the story, famous story with Hillel, which you may be familiar with, a convert came to Hillel, potential convert, and said to the famous sage Hillel, teach me the essence of Judaism standing on one foot. And Hillel said to him, the essence of Judaism is what you hate, don't do to other people. What you don't want other people to do to you, don't do to other people. The rest is a commentary. The rest of the Torah is a way to have that effectuated, to make that actually happen. He didn't tell him in the Hebrew, the person was not a convert yet, because of course we believe that when a person properly converts to Judaism, they receive that additional neshama as a gift from God, which is parenthetically why it's important to convert properly, because if not, you're putting on a policeman's uniform, but you're not a policeman. You're putting on a judge's uniform, but you're not a judge. A doctor's hat, but you're not a doctor. You don't have And when it comes to judge, policemen, this and that, it's man-made, man-appointed. So who cares if somebody appoints? But when it comes to neshama, neshama comes from Hashem. You can't just decide that all of a sudden you have a neshama. You have to actually get that soul. And proper conversion brings that soul into the body. And Hashem, in fact, says this. That's what our Chumash tells us, that it is proper. It is possible to convert and so on. But until you do that, you don't have that extra level of neshama. You don't have that extra level of connection that is above being self-serving. And again, self-serving is not an insult. Self-serving is a beautiful, wonderful thing. If in fact you go through your life living on the level of everything I do to somebody else, I think first, would I want that person to act to me this way? And if the answer is no, I don't do it, that's amazing. But it's still self-serving. And to bring it to the next level, you have to study Tanya, have to study the mystical elements of Torah, and you have to really, at the end of the day, work very hard. It's not easy even to live on the simple level of just being careful of everything that you do and being mindful